thank you for coming. Thank you for being here. My name is Neil Donald Walsh. The following audio program contains selections from Conversations with God and Uncommon Dialogue, Book 2, concerning teaching children wisdom and the new spiritual politics. This is an extraordinary document. It is a message from God, and in it, God suggests a social, sexual, educational, political, economic, and theological revolution on this planet, the likes of which we have never seen and seldom imagined. That suggestion is made within the context of our own stated desires as the planet's inhabitants. We've said that we choose to create a better life for all, to elevate our consciousness, to seek a newer world. God will not condemn us no matter what we choose, but if we choose this, He is willing to show us the way. He will not force us, however, to take her suggestions, not now, not ever. What you have here is your latest, and for some of you perhaps, your first very real contact with God. This is a contact, and it is very real. My first experience of talking to God on your behalf occurred in 1991 and 92. I had written an angry letter to God, asking why my life had become such a monument to struggle and failure. In everything, from my romantic relationships to my life work to my interactions with my children to my health, in everything, I was experiencing nothing but struggle and failure. My letter to God demanded to know why and what it took to make life work. To my astonishment, that letter was answered. How it was answered and what those answers were became a book, published in May of 1995 under the title Conversations with God, Book 1. On a blank sheet of paper, I would merely write a question, usually the first question that came to my head, and no sooner was the question written than the answer would form in my head, as if someone were whispering in my ear. I was taking dictation. With the exception of these words I'm now speaking, all the material in this book was placed on paper between spring of 1993 and a little over a year later. I'd like to present it to you now, just as it came from me and was given to me. It is Easter Sunday, 1993, and, as instructed, I'm here. I'm here, pencil in hand, writing pad before me, ready to begin. Oh, I should tell you, God asked me to be here. We had a date. Today, we shall find God together. That's always the best way to find God, you know. Together, we shall never find God apart. I mean that two ways. I mean we shall never find God so long as we are apart. For the first step in finding that we are not apart from God is finding that we are not apart from each other. And until we know and realize that all of us are one, we cannot know and realize that we and God are one. Our initial dialogue, God's and mine, was concluded just a month ago. I assume this one will go just like the first. That is, I ask questions and God answers, so I guess I'll just stop right now and ask God right now. The interesting thing about talking with you is that you always leave me with more questions than answers. Now I have questions about politics as well as sex.
Some say they're the same thing, that in politics all you ever do is get...
Wait a minute. You're not going to use an obscenity, are you?
Well, yes. I thought I would shock you a little.
Hey, cut it out. God isn't supposed to talk like that.
Then why do you?
Well, most of us don't.
The hell you don't.
Well, those people who are God-fearing don't.
Oh, I see. You have to fear God in order not to offend Him. And who says I am offended anyway by a simple word? Finally, don't you find it interesting that a word some of you use in the height of passion to describe great sex, you also use as your highest insult? Does that tell you anything about the way you feel about sexuality?
I think you've gotten confused. I don't think people use that term to describe a glorious, truly romantic sexual moment.
Oh, really? Have you been in any bedrooms lately?
No, have you?
I am in all of them, all of the time.
Well, that should make us all feel comfortable.
What? Are you saying that you do things in your bedroom that you wouldn't do in front of God?
Most people aren't comfortable with anyone watching, much less God.
Yet in some cultures, Aboriginal, some Polynesian, lovemaking is done quite openly.
Yes, well, most people haven't progressed to that level of freedom. In fact, they would consider such behavior regression to a primitive pagan state.
These people you call pagans have an enormous respect for life. They know nothing of rape, and there are virtually no killings in their societies. Your society puts sex, a very natural, normal human function, under cover, then turns around and kills people right out in the open. That is the obscenity. You've made sex so dirty, shameful, taboo, that you're embarrassed to do it.
Nonsense. Most people simply have a different, they might even say a higher, sense of propriety about sex. They consider it a private interacting, for some, a sacred part of their relationship.
Lack of privacy does not equal lack of sanctity. Most of humanity's most sacred rites are performed in public. Do not confuse privacy with sanctity. Most of your worst actions are done in private, and you save only your best behavior for public display. This is not an argument for public sex. It is merely a noting that privacy does not necessarily equal sanctity, nor does publicity rob you of it. As for propriety, that single word and the behavioral concept behind it have done more to inhibit men's and women's greatest joys than any other human construction, except the idea that God is punitive, which finished the job.
Apparently you don't believe in propriety.
The trouble with propriety is that someone has to set the standards. This means automatically that your behaviors are being limited, directed, dictated by someone else's idea of what should bring you joy. In matters of sexuality, as in all other matters, this can be more than limiting. It can be devastating. I can think of nothing more sad than a man or woman feeling they'd like to experience some things, then holding back because they think that what they've dreamt of, fantasized about, would violate the standards of propriety. Mind you, it's not something that they wouldn't do. It's just something that violates propriety. Not just in matters of sexuality, but in all of life. Never, ever, ever fail to do something simply because it might violate someone else's standards of propriety. If I had one bumper sticker on my car, it would read, "Violate propriety." I would certainly put such a sign in every bedroom.
But our sense of what's right and wrong is what holds society together. How can we cohabitate if we have no agreement on that?
Propriety has nothing to do with your relative values of rightness or wrongness. You might all agree that it's wrong to kill a man, but is it wrong to run naked in the rain? You might all agree that it's wrong to take a neighbor's wife, but is it wrong to take your own wife or have your wife take you in a particularly delicious way? Propriety seldom refers to legalistic limitations, but more often to simpler matters of what is deemed appropriate. Appropriate behavior is not always the behavior that's in what you call your best interests. It is rarely the behavior that brings you the most joy.
Getting back to sexuality, you're saying then that any behavior is acceptable behavior so long as there is mutual consent among those involved and affected?
Shouldn't that be true of all of life?
But sometimes we don't know who will be affected or how.
You must be sensitive to that. You must be keenly aware. And where you truly cannot know and cannot guess, you must err on the side of love. The central question in any decision is, what would love do now? Love for yourself and love for all others who are affected or involved. If you love another, you will not do anything that you believe could or would hurt that person. If there is any question or doubt, you will wait until you can get to clarity on the matter.
But that means others can hold you hostage. All they have to say is that such and such a thing would hurt them, and your actions are restricted.
Only by yourself. Wouldn't you want to restrict your own actions to those which do not damage the ones you love?
But what if you feel damaged by not doing something?
Then you must tell your loved one your truth. That you are feeling hurt, frustrated, reduced by not doing a certain thing, that you would like to do this thing, that you would like your loved one's agreement that you may do it. You must strive to seek such an agreement. Work to strike a compromise. Seek a course of action in which everybody can win.
And if such a course cannot be found?
Then I'll repeat what I've said before. Betrayal of yourself in order not to betray another is betrayal nonetheless. It is the highest betrayal. Shakespeare put this another way. To thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night the day, thou canst not then be false to any man.
But the man who always goes with what he wants becomes a very selfish man. I can't believe you're advocating this.
You assume that man will always make what you call the selfish choice. I tell you this, man is capable of making the highest choice. Yet I also tell you this, the highest choice is not always the choice which seems to serve another.
In other words, sometimes we must put ourselves first.
Oh, always put yourself first. Then, depending upon what you are trying to do or what you are seeking to experience, you will make your choice. When your purpose, your life purpose, is very high, so will your choices also be. Putting yourself first does not mean being what you term selfish. It means being self-aware.
You lay a pretty broad basis for the conduct of human affairs.
It is only through the exercise of the greatest freedom that the greatest growth is achieved, or even possible. If all you are doing is following someone else's rules, then you have not grown, you have obeyed. Contrary to your constructions, obedience is not what I want from you. Obedience is not growth, and growth is what I desire.
Okay, so within these broad parameters you've laid out, may I ask you some final questions about sex before we leave the subject?
Shoot.
If sex is so wonderful a part of the human experience, why do so many spiritual teachers preach abstinence? And why were so many masters apparently celibate?
For the same reason most of them have been depicted as living simply. Those who evolve to a high level of understanding bring their bodily desires into balance with their minds and souls. You are three-part beings, and most people experience themselves as a body. Even the mind is forgotten after age 30. No one reads anymore, no one writes, no one teaches, no one learns. The mind is forgotten. It is not nourished. It is not expanded. No new input, the minimum output required. The mind is not fed. It is not awakened. It is lulled, dulled. You do everything you can to disengage it. Television, movies, pulp, paperbacks. Whatever you do, don't think, don't think, don't think. So most people live life on a body level. Feed the body, clothe the body, give the body stuff. Most people haven't read a good book. I mean a book from which they can learn something. In years. But they can tell you the entire television schedule for the week. There's something extraordinarily sad in that. The truth is, most people don't want to have to think. They elect leaders. They support governments. They adopt religions requiring no independent thought. Make it easy for me. Tell me what to do. Most people want that. Where do I sit? When do I stand? How should I salute? When do I pay? What do you wish me to do? What are the rules? Where are my boundaries? Tell me, tell me, tell me. I'll do it. Somebody just tell me. Then they get disgusted, disillusioned. They followed all the rules. They did as they were told. What went wrong? When did it turn sour? Why did it fall apart? It fell apart the moment you abandoned your mind, the greatest creative tool you ever had. It's time to make friends with your mind again. Be a companion to it. It felt so alone. Be a nourisher of it. It's been so starved. Some of you, a small minority, have understood that you have a body and a mind. You've treated your mind well. Still, even among those of you who honor your mind and things of the mind, few have learned to use the mind at more than one-tenth its capacity. If you knew of what your mind is capable, you would never cease to partake of its wonders and its powers. And if you think the number of you who balance your life between your body and your mind is small, the number who see yourselves as three-part beings, body, mind, and spirit, is minuscule. Yet you are three-part beings. You are more than your body and more than a body with a mind. Are you nurturing your soul? Are you even noticing it? Are you healing it or hurting it? Are you growing or withering? Are you expanding or contracting? Is your soul as lonely as your mind? Is it even more neglected? And when was the last time you felt your soul being expressed? When was the last time you cried with joy? Wrote poetry, made music, danced in the rain, baked a pie, painted anything? Fixed something that was broken? Kissed a baby? Held a cat to your face? Hiked up a hill, swam naked? Walked at sunrise? Played the harmonica? Talked till dawn? Made love for hours? On a beach? In the woods? Communed with nature? Searched for God? When was the last time you sat alone with the silence, traveling to the deepest part of your being? When was the last time you said hello to your soul? When you live as a single-faceted creature, you become deeply mired in matters of the body, money, sex, power, possessions, physical stimulations and satisfactions, security, fame, financial gain. When you live as a dual-faceted creature, you broaden your concerns to include matters of the mind, companionship, creativity, stimulation of new thoughts, new ideas, creation of new goals, new challenges, personal growth. When you live as a three-part being, you come at last into balance with yourself. Your concerns include matters of the soul, spiritual identity, life purpose, relationship to God, path of evolution, spiritual growth, ultimate destiny. As you evolve into higher and higher states of consciousness, you bring into full realization every aspect of your being. Yet evolution does not mean dropping some aspects of self in favor of others. It simply means expanding focus, turning away from almost exclusive involvement with one aspect toward genuine love and appreciation for all aspects.
Then why do so many teachers espouse complete abstinence from sex?
Because they do not believe that humans can achieve a balance. They believe the sexual energy and the energies surrounding otherworldly experiences is too powerful to simply moderate, to bring into balance. They believe abstinence is the only way to spiritual evolution, rather than merely one possible result of it.
Yet isn't it true that some beings who are highly evolved have given up sex?
Not in the classic sense of the words, to give up. It is not a forced letting go of something you still want, but know is no good to have. It's more of a simple releasing, a movement away from, as one pushes oneself away from the second helping of dessert. Not because the dessert is no good. Not even because it's no good for you. But simply because, wonderful as it was, you've had enough. When you can drop your involvement with sex for that reason, you may want to do so. Then again, you may not. You may never decide that you've had enough, and may always want this experience in balance with the other experiences of your beingness. That's okay. That's all right. The sexually active are no less qualified for enlightenment, no less spiritually evolved than the sexually inactive. What enlightenment and evolution do cause you to drop is your addiction to sex, your deep need to have the experience, your compulsive behaviors. So, too, your preoccupation with money, power, security, possessions, and other experiences of the body will vanish. Yet your genuine appreciation for them will not and should not. Appreciation for all of life is what honors the process I have created. Disdain for life or any of its joys, even the most basic physical ones, is disdain for me, the Creator. For when you call my creation unholy, you call me. Yet when you call my creation sacred, you sanctify your experience of it and me as well. I tell you this. I have created nothing disdainful. And as your Shakespeare said, nothing is evil, lest thinking make it so.
This leads me to some other final questions about sex. Is any kind of sex between consenting adults okay?
Yes.
I mean kinky sex, or even loveless sex, or even gay sex.
First, let's be once again clear that nothing is disapproved of by God. I do not sit here in judgment, calling one action good and another evil. Now, within the context of what serves you or disserves you on your path of evolution, only you can decide that. There's a broad-based guideline, however, upon which most evolved souls have agreed. No action which causes hurt to another leads to rapid evolution. There's a second guideline as well. No action involving another may be taken without the other's agreement and permission. Now let us consider the questions you just asked within the context of these guidelines. Kinky sex? Well, if it hurts no one, and is done with everyone's permission, what reason would anyone have to call it wrong? Loveless sex? Sex for the sake of sex has been debated from the beginning of time. I often think whenever I hear this question that I'd like to go into a room full of people someday and say, everybody here who's never had sex outside of a relationship of deep, lasting, committed, abiding love, raise your hand.
Let me just say this. Loveless anything is not the fastest way to the goddess. Whether it's loveless sex or loveless spaghetti and meatballs, if you've prepared the feast and are consuming it without love, you're missing the most extraordinary part of the experience. Is it wrong to miss that? Well, here again, wrong may not be the operative word. Disadvantageous would be closer, given that you desire to evolve into a higher spiritual being as rapidly as you can. Gay sex? So many people want to say that I am against gay sexuality or the acting out of it. Yet I make no judgment on this or any other choice you make. People want to make all kinds of value judgments about everything. And I kind of spoil the party. I won't join them in those judgments, which is especially disconcerting to those who say that I originated them. I do observe this. There was once a time when people thought that marriage between people of differing races was not only inadvisable, but against the law of God. Amazingly, some people still think this. They pointed to their Bible as their authority, even as they do for their authority on questions surrounding homosexuality.
You mean it is okay for people of differing races to join together in marriage?
The question is absurd. But not nearly as absurd as some people's certainty that the answer is no.
Are the questions on homosexuality equally absurd?
You decide. I have no judgment about that or anything. I know you wish that I did. That would make your lives a lot easier. No decisions to make, no tough calls, everything decided for you, nothing to do but obey. Not much of a life, at least in terms of creativity or self-empowerment. But what the heck? No stress either.
Let me ask you some questions about sex and children. At what age is it appropriate to allow children to become aware of sexuality as a life experience?
Children are aware of themselves as sexual beings, which is to say as human beings, from the outset of their lives. What many parents on your planet now do is try to discourage them from noticing that. If a baby's hand goes to the wrong place, you move it away. If a tiny child begins to find moments of self-pleasure in its innocent delight with its own body, you react in horror and pass that sense of horror on to your child. The child wonders, what did I do? What did I do? Mommy's mad. What did I do? With your race of beings, it has not been a question of when you introduce your offspring to sex. It has been a question of when you stop demanding that they deny their own identity as sexual beings. Somewhere between the ages of 12 and 17, most of you give up the fight already and say essentially, although naturally not with words, you don't speak of these things, okay, now you can notice that you have sexual parts and sexual things to do with them. Yet by this time, the damage has been done. Your children have been shown for 10 years or more that they are to be ashamed of those body parts. Some are not even told the proper name for them. They hear everything from wee-wee to your bottom to words some of you must strain mightily to invent, all to avoid simply saying penis or vagina. Having thus gotten very clear that all things having to do with those parts of the body are to be hidden, not spoken of, denied, your offspring then explode into puberty, not knowing at all what to make of what's going on with them. They've had no preparation at all. Of course, then they act miserable, responding to their newest and most urgent urges awkwardly, if not inappropriately. This is not necessary, nor do I observe it as serving your offspring, far too many of whom enter their adult lives with sexual taboos, inhibitions, and hang-ups to beat the band. Now, in enlightened societies, offspring are never discouraged, reprimanded, or corrected when they begin to find early delight in the nature of their very being. Nor is the sexuality of their parents, that is, the identity of their parents as sexual beings, particularly avoided or necessarily hidden. Naked bodies, whether of the parents or the children or their siblings, are seen and treated as being totally natural, totally wonderful, and totally okay, not as things of which to be ashamed. Sexual functions are also seen and treated as totally natural, totally wonderful, and totally okay. In some societies, parents couple in full view of their offspring. And what could give children a greater sense of the beauty and the wonder and the pure joy and the total okayness of the sexual expression of love than this? For parents are constantly modeling the rightness and wrongness of all behaviors. And children pick up subtle and not so subtle signals from their parents about everything through what they see their parents thinking, saying, and doing. As noted earlier, you may call such societies pagan or primitive, yet it is observable that in such societies, rape and crimes of passion are virtually non-existent. Prostitution is laughed at as being absurd, and sexual inhibitions and dysfunctions are unheard of. While such openness is not recommended just now for your own society, and all but the most extraordinary of settings, it would no doubt be far too culturally stigmatizing, it is time that the so-called modern civilizations on your planet do something to end the repression, guilt, and shame which too often surrounds and characterizes the totality of your society's sexual expression and experience.
Suggestions? Ideas?
Stop teaching children from the very beginning of their lives that things having to do with the very natural functioning of their bodies are shameful and wrong. Discontinue demonstrating to your offspring that anything sexual is to be hidden. Allow your children to see and observe the romantic side of you. Let them see you hugging, touching, gently fondling. Let them see that their parents love each other and that showing their love physically is something that is very natural and very wonderful. It would surprise you to know in how many families such a simple lesson has never been taught. When your children begin to embrace their own sexual feelings, curiosities, and urges, cause them to connect this new and expanding experience of themselves with an inner sense of joy and celebration, not guilt and shame. And for heaven's sake, stop hiding your bodies from your children. It's okay if they see you swimming in the nude in a country water hole on a camping trip or in the backyard pool. Don't go into apoplexy should they catch a glimpse of you moving from the bedroom to the bathroom without a robe. End this frantic need to cover up, close off, shut down any opportunity, however innocent, for your child to be introduced to you as a being with your own sexual identity. Children think their parents are asexual because their parents have portrayed themselves that way. They then imagine that they must be this way because all children emulate their parents. Therapists will tell you that some grown-up offspring have, to this very day, the most difficult time imagining their parents actually doing it, which, of course, fills these offspring, now patients in the therapist's office, with rage or guilt or shame, because they naturally desire to do it, and they can't figure out what's wrong with them. So talk about sex with your children. Laugh about sex with your children. teach them and allow them and remind them and show them how to celebrate their sexuality. That is what you can do for your children. And you do this from the day they are born, with the first kiss, the first hug, the first touch they receive from you, and that they see you receiving from each other.
Thank you. Thank you. I was so hoping that you'd bring some sanity to this subject. But one final question. When is it appropriate to specifically introduce or discuss or describe sexuality with your children?
They will tell you when the time has come. Each child will make it clear unmistakably if you are really watching and listening. It comes in increments, actually. It arrives incrementally. And you will know the age-appropriate way of dealing with the incremental arrival of your child's sexuality if you are clear. If you are finished with your own unfinished business about all of this.
How do we get to that place?
Do what it takes. Enroll in a seminar, see a therapist, join a group, read a book, meditate on it. Discover each other. Most of all, discover each other as male and female again. Discover, revisit, regain, reclaim your own sexuality. Celebrate that. Enjoy that. Own that. Own your own joyful sexuality, and then you can allow and encourage your children to own theirs.
Again, thank you. Now, getting away from the consideration of children and moving back to the larger subject of human sexuality, I have to ask you one more question. And it may seem impertinent, and it may seem flippant even, but I can't let this dialogue end without asking it.
Well, stop apologizing and just
ask it. Ask it, yes, all right. Well, is there such a thing as too much sex?
No, of course not. But there is such a thing as too much of a need for sex. I suggest this. Enjoy everything. Need nothing.
Including people?
Including people. Especially people. Needing someone is the fastest way to kill a relationship.
But we all like to feel needed.
Then stop it. Like to feel unneeded instead. But the greatest gift you can give someone is the strength and the power not to need you. To need you for nothing.
Okay. Okay, I'm ready to move on. You promised to talk about some of the larger aspects of life on Earth. And ever since your comments about life in the United States, I've wanted to talk more about all of this.
Yes, good. I want to address some of the larger issues facing your planet. And there is no larger issue than the education of your offspring.
We're not doing that well, are we? I can tell by the way you brought that up.
Well, of course, everything is relative. Relative to what you say you are trying to do, no, you're not doing it well.
I thought so.
Everything I say here, everything I've included in this discussion so far and have caused to be placed in this document must be put into that context. I'm not making judgments of rightness or wrongness, goodness or badness. I simply make observations of your effectiveness relative to what you say you are trying to do.
I understand that.
I know that you say you do, but the time may come, even before this dialogue is finished, when you will accuse me of being judgmental.
I would never accuse you of that. I know better.
Knowing better has not stopped the human race from calling me a judgmental god in the past.
Well, it will stop me.
We shall see.
You wanted to talk about education.
Indeed. I observe that most of you have misunderstood the meaning, the purpose, and the function of education, to say nothing of the process by which it is best undertaken.
That's a huge statement, and I need some help with it.
Most of the human race has decided that the meaning and the purpose and the function of education is to pass on knowledge. But to educate someone is to give them knowledge. Generally, the accumulated knowledge of one's particular family, clan, tribe, society, nation, and world. Yet education has very little to do with knowledge.
Oh, you could have fooled me.
Clearly.
Well, what does it have to do with, then?
Wisdom.
Wisdom?
Yes.
Okay, I give up. What's the difference?
Wisdom is knowledge applied.
So, we aren't supposed to try to give our offspring knowledge. We're supposed to try to give them wisdom.
First of all, don't try to do anything. Do it. Secondly, don't ignore knowledge in favor of wisdom. That would be fatal. On the other hand, don't ignore wisdom in favor of knowledge. That would also be fatal. It would kill education. On your planet, it is killing it.
We are ignoring wisdom in favor of knowledge?
In most cases, yes.
How are we doing this?
You're teaching your children what to think instead of how to think.
Explain, please.
Certainly. When you give your children knowledge, you're telling them what to think. That is, you're telling them what they are supposed to know. What you want them to understand is true. When you give your children wisdom, you do not tell them what to know or what is true, but rather how to get to their own truth.
But without knowledge, there can be no wisdom.
Agreed. That is why I have said you cannot ignore knowledge in favor of wisdom. A certain amount of knowledge must be passed on from one generation to the next, obviously. But as little knowledge as possible, the smaller amount the better. Let the child discover for itself. Know this, knowledge is lost, wisdom is never forgotten.
So our schools should teach as little as possible?
Your school should turn their emphasis around. Right now they are focused highly on knowledge and paying precious little attention to wisdom. Classes in critical thinking, problem solving, and logic are considered by many parents to be threatening. They want such classes out of the curriculum. As well they might, if they want to protect their way of life. Because children who are allowed to develop their own critical thinking processes are very much likely to abandon their parents' morals, standards, and entire way of life. In order to protect your way of life, you have built an education system based upon the development in the child of memories, not abilities. Children are taught to remember facts and fictions, the fictions each society has set up about itself, rather than give the ability to discover and create their own truths. Programs calling for children to develop abilities and skills rather than memories are soundly ridiculed by those who imagine that they know what a child needs to learn. Yet what you have been teaching your children has led your world toward ignorance, not away from it.
Our schools don't teach fictions, they teach facts.
Now you are lying to yourself, just as you lie to your children.
We lie to our children?
Of course you do. Pick up any history book and see. Your histories are written by people who want their children to see the world from a particular point of view. Any attempt to expand historical accounts with a larger view of the facts is sneered at and called revisionist. You will not tell the truth about your past to your children, lest they see you for what you really are. Most history is written from the point of view of that segment of your society you would call white Anglo-Saxon Protestant males. When females or blacks or others in the minority say, "Hey, wait a minute, this isn't how it happened. You've left out a huge part here." You cringe and holler and demand that the revisionists stop trying to change your textbooks. You don't want your children to know how it really happened. You want them to know how you justified what happened from your point of view. Shall I give you an example of this?
Please.
In the United States, you do not teach your children everything there is to know about your country's decision to drop atom bombs on two Japanese cities, killing or maiming hundreds of thousands of people. Rather, you give them the facts as you see them and as you want them to see them. When an attempt is made to balance this point of view with the point of view of another, in this case the Japanese, you scream and rage and rant and rave and jump up and down and demand that schools don't dare even think about presenting such data in their historical review of this important event. Thus, you have not taught history at all, but politics. History is supposed to be an accurate and full account of what actually happened. Politics is never about what actually happened. Politics is always one's point of view about what happened. History reveals, politics justifies. History uncovers, tells all. Politics covers, tells only one side. Politicians hate history truly written, and history truly written speaks not so well of politicians either. Yet you are wearing the emperor's new clothes, for your children ultimately see right through you. Children taught to critically think, look at your history and say, my, how my parents and elders have deluded themselves. This you cannot tolerate, so you drum it out of them. You do not want your children to have the most basic facts. You want them to have your take on the facts.
Well, I think you're exaggerating here. I think you've taken this argument a little far.
Really? Most people in your society don't even want their children to know the most basic facts of life. People went bananas when schools simply started teaching children how the human body functions. Now you're not supposed to tell children how AIDS is transmitted or how to stop it from being transmitted. Unless, of course, you tell them from a particular point of view how to avoid AIDS. Then it is all right. But simply give them the facts and let them decide for themselves? Not on your life.
Children are not ready to decide these things for themselves. They have to be properly guided.
Have you looked at your world lately?
What? What about it?
That's how you've guided your children in the past.
No, it's how we misguided them. If the world is in rotten shape today, and in many ways it is, it's not because we've tried to teach our children the old values, but because we've allowed them to be taught all this newfangled stuff.
You really believe that, don't you?
You're damned right I really believe it. If we just kept our children limited to the 3 R's instead of feeding them all this critical thinking garbage, we'd be a lot better off today. If we kept so-called sex education out of the classroom and in the home where it belonged, we wouldn't be seeing teenagers having babies and single mothers at 17 applying for welfare and a world run amok. If we'd insisted that our young ones live by our moral standards rather than letting them go off and create their own, we wouldn't have turned our once strong, vibrant nation into a pitiable imitation of its former self.
I see.
And one more thing. Don't stand there and tell me how we're supposed to suddenly see ourselves as wrong for what we did at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We ended the war, for God's sake. We saved thousands of lives on both sides. It was the price of war. Nobody liked the decision, but it had to be made.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Yeah, you see. You're just like all the rest of those El Pinko liberal commies. You want us to revise our history, all right. You want us to revise ourselves right out of existence. Then you liberals can have your way at last. Take over the world. Create your own decadent societies. Redistribute the wealth. Power to the people and all that crap. Except that's never gotten us anywhere. What we need is a return to the past, to the values of our forefathers. That's what we need.
Done now?
Yeah, I'm done. How did I do?
I'm pretty good. That was really good.
Well, when you've been around talk radio for a few years, it comes pretty easily.
That is how people on your planet think, isn't it?
You bet it is, and not just in America either. I mean, you could change the name of the country and change the name of the war, or insert any offensive military action by any nation at any time in history. It doesn't matter. Everybody thinks they're right. Everybody knows it's the other person who's wrong. Forget about Hiroshima. Insert Berlin instead, or Bosnia. Everybody knows the old values are the ones which worked, too. Everybody knows the world is going to hell. Not just in America, all over. There's a hue and a cry for a return to old values and for a return to nationalism everywhere on the planet.
Well, I know that there is.
And what I've done here is try to articulate that feeling, that concern, that outrage.
You did a good job. Almost had me convinced.
Well, what do you say? I mean, what do you say to those who really think like this?
I say, do you really think things were better 30 years ago? 40 years ago? 50 years ago? I say memory has poor vision. You remember the good of it, not the worst of it. It's natural. It's normal. But don't be deceived. Do some critical thinking, not just memorizing what others want you to think. To stay with our example, do you really imagine how it was absolutely necessary to drop the atom bomb on Hiroshima? What do your American historians say about the many reports by those who claim to know more about what really happened? That the Japanese Empire had privately revealed to the United States its willingness to end the war before the bomb was dropped. How much of a part did revenge for the horror of Pearl Harbor play in the bombing decision? And if you accept that dropping the Hiroshima bomb was necessary, why was it necessary to drop a second bomb? It could be, of course, that your own account of all this is correct. It could be that the American point of view on all this is the way it actually happened. And that is not the point of this discussion. The point here is that your educational system does not allow for critical thinking on these issues, or very many other issues, for that matter. Can you imagine what would happen to a social studies or history teacher in Iowa who asked a class the above questions, inviting and encouraging the students to examine and explore the issues in depth and draw their own conclusions? That is the point. You don't want your young ones drawing their own conclusions. You want them to come to the same conclusions you came to. Thus you doom them to repeat the mistakes to which your conclusions led you.
What about these statements made by so many people about old values and the disintegration of our society today? What about the incredible rise in teen births or welfare mothers or our world run amok?
Your world has run amok. On this I will agree. But your world has not run amok because of what you have allowed your schools to teach your children. It has run amok because of what you have not allowed them to teach. You have not allowed your schools to teach that love is all there is. You have not allowed your schools to speak of a love which is unconditional.
Hell, we won't even allow our religions to speak of that.
That's right. And you will not allow your offspring to be taught to celebrate themselves and their bodies, their humanness and their wondrous sexual selves. And you will not allow your children to know that they are first and foremost spiritual beings inhabiting a body. Nor do you treat your children as spirits coming into bodies. In societies where sexuality is openly spoken of, freely discussed, joyously explained and experienced, there is virtually no sexual crime, only a tiny number of births which occur when they are not expected, and no illegitimate or unwanted births. In highly evolved societies, all births are blessings, and all mothers and all children have their welfare looked after. Indeed, the society would have it no other way. In societies where history is not bent to the views of the strongest and most powerful, the mistakes of the past are openly acknowledged and never repeated, and once is enough for behaviors which are clearly self-destructive. In societies where critical thinking and problem-solving and skills for living are taught, rather than facts simply memorized, even so-called justifiable actions of the past are held up to intense scrutiny. Nothing is accepted on face value.
How would that work? Let's use our example from World War II. How would a school system teaching life skills rather than merely facts approach the historical episode at Hiroshima?
Your teachers would describe to their class exactly what happened there. They would include all the facts, which led up to that event. They would seek the views of historians from both sides of the encounter, realizing that there is more than one point of view on everything. They would then not ask the class to memorize the facts of the matter. Instead, they would challenge the class. They would say, "Now you've heard all about this event. You know all that came before and all that happened after. We've given you as much of the knowledge of this event as we could get our hands on. Now, from this knowledge, what wisdom comes to you? If you were chosen to solve the problems which were being faced in those days and which were solved by the dropping of the bomb, how would you solve them? Can you think of a better way?"
Oh, sure, that's easy. Anybody can come up with answers that way. With the benefit of hindsight, anybody can look over their shoulder and say, "I would have done it differently."
Then why don't you?
I beg your pardon?
I said, then why don't you? Why have you not looked over your shoulder, learned from your past, and done it differently? I'll tell you why. Because to allow your children to look at your past and analyze it critically, indeed to require them to do so as a part of their education, would be to run the risk of them disagreeing with how you did things. They will disagree anyway, of course. You just won't allow too much of it in your classrooms, so they have to take to the streets, wave signs, tear up draft cards, burn bras and flags, do whatever they can do to get your attention, to get you to see. Your young people have been screaming at you, "There must be a better way," yet you do not hear them. You do not want to hear them. And you certainly don't want to encourage them in the classroom to start critically thinking about the facts you are giving them. Just get it, you say to them. Don't come in here and tell us we've been doing it wrong. Just get that we've been doing it right. That's how you educate your children. That's what you've been calling education.
But there are those who would say it's the young people and their crazy, wacko, liberal ideas who have taken this country and this world down the tubes, sent it to hell, pushed it to the edge of oblivion, destroyed our values-oriented culture and replaced it with a do-whatever-you-want-to-do, whatever-feels-good morality, which threatens to end our very way of life.
The young people are destroying your way of life. The young people have always done that. Your job is to encourage it, not discourage it. It is not your young people who are destroying the rainforests. They're asking you to stop it. It is not your young people who are depleting your ozone layer. They're asking you to stop it. It is not your young people who are exploiting the poor in sweatshops all over the world. They are asking you to stop it. It is not your young people who are taxing you to death, then using the money for war and machines of war. They are asking you to stop it. It is not your young people who are ignoring the problems of the weak and the downtrodden, letting hundreds of people die of starvation every day on a planet with more than enough to feed everybody. They are asking you to stop it. It is not your young people who are engaging in the politics of deception and manipulation. They are asking you to stop it. It is not your young people who are sexually repressed, ashamed, and embarrassed about their own bodies and passing on this shame and embarrassment to their offspring. They are asking you to stop it. It is not your young people who have set up a value system which says that might is right and a world which solves problems with violence. They are asking you to stop it. Nay, they are not asking you. They are begging you.
Yet it is young people who are violent. Young people who join gangs and kill each other. Young people who thumb their nose at law and order and any kind of order. Young people who are driving us crazy.
When the cries and pleas of young people to change the world are not heard and never heeded, when they see that their cause is lost, that you will have it your way no matter what, young people who are not stupid will do the next best thing. If they can't beat you, they will join you. Your young people have joined you in your behaviors. If they are violent, it is because you are violent. If they are materialistic, it is because you are materialistic. If they are acting crazy, it is because you are acting crazy. And if they are using sex manipulatively, irresponsibly, shamefully, it is because they see you doing the same. The only difference between young people and older people is that young people do what they do out in the open. Older people hide their behaviors. Older people think that young people cannot see. Yet young people see everything. Nothing is hidden from them. They see the hypocrisy of their elders and they try desperately to change it. Yet having tried and failed, they see no choice but to imitate it. In this they are wrong. Yet they have never been taught differently. They have not been allowed to critically analyze what their elders have been doing. They have only been allowed to memorize it. What you memorize, you memorialize.
How, then, should we educate our young?
First, treat them as spirits. They are spirits entering a physical body. That is not an easy thing for a spirit to do. Not an easy thing for a spirit to get used to. It is very confining, very limiting. So the child will cry out at suddenly being so limited. Hear this cry. Understand it. And give your children as much of a sense of unlimitedness as you possibly can. Next, introduce them to the world you have created with gentleness and care. Be full of care. That is to say, be careful of what you put into their memory storage units. Children remember everything they see, everything they experience. Why do you spank your children the moment they exit the womb? Do you really imagine this is the only way to get their engines going? Why do you take your babies away from their mothers minutes after they have been separated from the only life form they have known in all of their present existence? Will not the measuring and the weighing and the prodding and the poking wait for just a moment while the newly born experience the safety and the comfort of that which has given it life? Why do you allow some of the earliest images to which your child is exposed to be images of violence? Who told you this was good for your children? And why do you hide images of love? Why do you teach your children to be ashamed and embarrassed of their own bodies and their functions by shielding your own body from them and telling them not to ever touch themselves in ways which pleasure them? What message do you send them about pleasure? And what lessons about the body? Why do you place your children in schools where competition is allowed and encouraged, where being the best and learning the most is rewarded, where performance is graded and moving at one's own pace is barely tolerated? What does your child understand from this? Why do you not teach your children of movement and music and the joy of art and the mystery of fairy tales and the wonder of life? Why do you not bring out what is naturally found in the child rather than seek to put in what is unnatural to the child? And why do you not allow your young ones to learn logic and critical thinking and problem solving and creation, using the tools of their own intuition and their deepest inner knowing, rather than the rules and the memorized systems and conclusions of a society which has already proven itself to be wholly unable to evolve by these methods, yet continues to use them? Finally, teach concepts, not subjects. Devise a new curriculum and build it around three core concepts: awareness, honesty, responsibility. Teach your children these concepts from the earliest age. Have them run through the curriculum until the final day. Base your entire educational model upon them. Birth all instruction deep within them.
I don't understand what that would mean.
It means everything you teach would come from within these concepts.
Can you explain that? How would we teach the three R's?
From the earliest primers to your more sophisticated readers, all tales, stories, and subject matter would revolve around the core concepts. That is, they would be stories of awareness, stories dealing with honesty, stories about responsibility. Your children would be introduced to the concepts, injected into the concepts, immersed in the concepts. Writing tasks, likewise, would revolve around these core concepts and others which are attendant to them as the child grows in the ability to self-express. Even computation skills would be taught within this framework. Arithmetic and mathematics are not abstractions, but are the most basic tools in the universe for living life. The teaching of all computation skills would be contextualized within the larger life experience in a way which draws attention to and places focus upon the core concepts and their derivatives.
What are these derivatives?
Well, to use a phrase which your media people have made popular, they are the spin-offs.
The entire educational model can be based on these spin-offs, replacing the subjects in your present curriculum, which teach basically facts.
For instance?
Well, let's use our imagination. What are some of the concepts which are important to you in life?
Well, I would say honesty, as you have said.
Yes, go ahead. That's a core concept.
And fairness, that's an important concept to me.
Good. Any others?
Treating others nicely, that's one. I don't know how to put that into a concept.
Go on, just let the thoughts flow.
Getting along, being tolerant, not hurting others, seeing others as equal. Those are all things I would hope I could teach
good.
My children.
Excellent. Keep going.
Believing in yourself. That's a good one. And, wait, there's one coming. Yeah, that's it. Walking in dignity. I guess I would call it walking in dignity. I don't know how to put that into a better concept either, but it has to do with the way one carries oneself in one's life, the way one honors others, and the path others are taking.
This is good stuff. This is all good stuff. You're getting down to it now. There are many other such concepts, which all children must deeply understand if they are to evolve and grow into complete human beings. Yet you do not teach these things in your schools. These are the most important things in life. These things we now are talking of. But you do not teach them in school. You do not teach what it means to be honest. You do not teach what it means to be responsible. You do not teach what it means to be aware of other people's feelings and respectful of other people's paths. You say it is up to parents to teach these things. Yet parents can only pass on what has been passed on to them. And the sins of the father have been visited upon the son. So you are teaching in your homes the same stuff your parents taught you in their homes.
So, what's wrong with that?
As I keep saying repeatedly here, taking a look at the world lately?
You keep bringing us back to that. You keep making us look at that. But all of that isn't our fault. We can't be blamed for the way the rest of the world is.
It's not a question of blame. It's a question of choice. And if you are not responsible for the choices humankind has been making and keeps making, who is?
Well, we can't keep making ourselves responsible for all of it.
I tell you this. Until you are willing to take responsibility for all of it, you cannot change any of it. You cannot keep saying, they did it, and they are doing it. And if only they would get it right. Remember the wonderful line from Walt Kelly's comic strip character Pogo, and never forget it. We have met the enemy, and they is us.
We've been repeating the same mistakes for hundreds of years, haven't we?
For thousands of years, my son. You've been making the same mistakes for thousands of years. Humankind has not evolved in its most basic instincts much beyond the caveman era. Yet every attempt to change that is met with scorn. Every challenge to look at your values, maybe even restructure them, is greeted with fear and then anger. Now along comes an idea for me to actually teach higher concepts in schools. Oh, boy. Now we're really treading on thin ice. Still, in highly evolved societies, that is exactly what is done.
Yes, but the problem is not all people agree on these concepts, on what they mean. That's why you can't teach them in our schools. Parents go nuts when you try to introduce these things into the curriculum. They say you're teaching values, that the school has no place in such instruction.
They are wrong. Again, based on what you say as a race of people that you're trying to do, which is build a better world. They are wrong. Schools are exactly the place for such instruction, precisely because schools are detached from parents' prejudices, precisely because schools are separated from parents' preconceived notions. You've seen what has resulted on your planet from the passing down of values from parent to child. Your planet is a mess. You don't understand the most basic concepts of civilized societies. You don't know how to solve conflict without violence. You don't know how to live without fear. You don't know how to act without self-interest. You don't know how to love without condition. These are basic, basic understandings, and you have not even begun to approach a full comprehension of them, much less implement them, after thousands and thousands of years.
Is there any way out of this mess?
Yes. It is in your schools. It is in the education of your young. Your hope is in the next generation and the next. But you must stop immersing them in the ways of the past. Those ways have not worked. They have not taken you where you say you want to go. Yet if you are not careful, you are going to get exactly where you are headed. So stop. Turn around. Sit down together and collect your thoughts. Create the grandest version of the greatest vision you ever had about yourselves as a human race. Then take the values and concepts which undergird such a vision and teach them in your schools. Why not courses such as Understanding Power?
peaceful conflict resolution.
Elements of loving relationships.
Personhood and self-creation.
Body, mind, and spirit, how they function.
Engaging creativity.
Celebrating self, valuing others.
Joyous sexual expression.
Fairness.
Tolerance.
Diversities and similarities.
Ethical economics.
Creative consciousness and mind power.
Awareness and wakefulness.
Honesty and responsibility.
Visibility and transparency.
Science and spirituality.
Much of this is taught right now. We call it social studies.
I'm not talking about a two-day unit in a semester-long course. I'm talking about separate courses on each of these things. I'm talking about a complete revision of your school's curricula. I am speaking of a values-based curriculum. You're now teaching what is largely a fact-based curriculum. I'm talking about focusing your child's attention as much on understanding the core concepts and the theoretical structures around which their value system may be reconstructed as you now do on dates and facts and statistics.
In the highly evolved societies of your galaxy and your universe, concepts for living are taught to offspring beginning at a very early age. What you call facts, which in those societies are considered far less important, are taught at a much later age. On your planet, you have created a society in which little Johnny has learned how to read before getting out of preschool, but still hasn't learned how to stop biting his brother. And Susie has perfected her multiplication tables using flashcards and rote memory in ever earlier and earlier grades, but has not learned that there is nothing shameful or embarrassing about her body. Right now, your schools exist primarily to provide answers. It would be far more beneficial if their primary function was to ask questions. What does it mean to be honest or responsible or fair? What are the implications? For that matter, what does it mean that 2 + 2 = 4? What are the implications? Highly evolved societies encourage all children to discover and create those answers for themselves.
But that would lead to chaos.
As opposed to the non-chaotic conditions under which you now live your life?
Okay. So it would lead to more chaos.
I'm not suggesting that your schools never share with your offspring any of the things which you have learned or decided about these things. Quite to the contrary. Schools serve their students when they share with young ones what elders have learned and discovered, decided and chosen in the past. Students may then observe how all this has worked. In your schools, however, you present these data to the student as that which is right, when the data really should be offered as simply that, data. Past data should not be the basis of present truth. Data from a prior time or experience should always and only be the basis for new questions. Always the treasure should be in the question, not in the answer. And always the questions are the same. With regard to this past data, which we have shown you, do you agree or do you disagree? What do you think? Always this is the key question. Always this is the focus. What do you think? What do you think? What do you think? Now, obviously, children will bring to this question the values of their parents. Parents will continue to have a strong role, obviously the primary role, in creating the child's system of values. The school's intention and purpose would be to encourage offspring from the earliest age until the end of formal education to explore those values and to learn how to use them, apply them, functionalize them, and yes, even to question them. For parents who do not want children questioning their values are not parents who love their children, but rather who love themselves through their children.
I wish, how I wish, that there were schools such as the ones you describe.
There are some which seek to approach this model.
There are?
Yes. Read the writings of the man called Rudolf Steiner. Explore the methods of the Waldorf school, which he developed.
Well, of course, I know all about those schools. Is this a commercial?
This is an observation.
Because you knew I was familiar with the Waldorf schools. You knew that.
Of course I knew that. Everything in your life has served you, brought you to this moment. I have not just started talking with you. I've been talking with you for years, through all of your associations and experiences.
You're saying the Waldorf school is the best?
No. I am saying it is a model which works, given where you say, as a human race, you want to go, given what you claim you want to do, given what you say you want to be. I am saying it is an example, one of several I could cite, although on your planet and your society they are rare, of how education may be accomplished in a way which focuses on wisdom more than simply knowledge.
Well, it's a model I very much approve of. There are many differences between the Waldorf school and other schools. Let me give you an example. It's just one, simple one, but it dramatically illustrates the point. In the Waldorf school, the teacher moves with the children through all levels of the primary and elementary learning experience. For all those years, the children have the same teacher, rather than moving from one person to another. Can you imagine the bond which is formed here? Can you see the value? The teacher comes to know the child as if it were his or her own. The child moves to a level of trust and love with the teacher, which opens doors many traditionally oriented schools never dreamed existed. At the end of those years, the teacher reverts back to the first grade, starting over again with another group of children and moving through all the years of the curriculum once more. A dedicated Waldorf teacher may wind up working with only four or five groups of children in an entire career, but he or she has meant something to those children beyond anything that is possible in a traditional school setting. This educational model recognizes and announces that the human relationship, the bonding and the love which is shared in such a paradigm, is just as important as any fact the teacher may impart to the child. It's like homeschooling outside the home.
Yes, it's a good model.
There are other good models?
Yes, and you are making some progress on your planet with regard to education, but it's very slow. Even the attempt to place a goals-oriented, skill development-focused curriculum in public schools has met with enormous resistance. People see it as threatening or ineffective. They want children to learn facts. Still, there are some inroads, yet there is much to be done. And that is only one area of the human experience which could use some overhauling, given what you say as human beings that you are seeking to be.
Yes, I should imagine the political arena could use some changes, too.
To be sure.
I've been waiting for this. This is more of what I assumed you were promising me when you told me that we would deal with planetary issues on a global scale. So can we begin to look at our human politics by my asking you what may seem like an elementary question?
No questions are undeserving or unworthy. Questions are like people.
Ah, good one. Okay, then, let me ask. Is it wrong to undertake a foreign policy based on your country's own vested interests?
No. First, from my standpoint, nothing is wrong. But I understand how you use the term, so I will speak within the context of your vocabulary. I use the term wrong to mean that which is not serving you, given who and what you choose to be. This is how I've always used the terms right and wrong with you. It is always within this context, for in truth, there is no right or wrong. So, within that context, no, it is not wrong to base foreign policy decisions on vested interest considerations. What is wrong is to pretend that you're not doing so. This most countries do, of course. They take action or fail to take action for one set of reasons, then give as a rationale another set of reasons.
Why? Why do countries do that?
Because governments know that if people understood the real reasons for most foreign policy decisions, the people would not support them. This is true of governments everywhere.
There are very few governments which do not deliberately mislead their people. Deception is part of government. For few people would choose to be governed the way they are governed. Few would choose to be governed at all, unless government convinced them that its decisions were for their own good. This is a hard convincing, but most people plainly see the foolishness in government. So government must lie to at least try to hold the people's loyalty. Government is the perfect portrayer of the accuracy of the axiom that if you lie big enough, long enough, the lie becomes the truth. People in power must never let the public know how they came to power, nor all that they've done and are willing to do to stay there. Truth and politics do not and cannot mix, because politics is the art of saying only what needs to be said, and saying it in just the right way, in order to achieve a desired end. Not all politics are bad. But the art of politics is a practical art. It recognizes with great candor the psychology of most people. It simply notices that most people operate out of self-interest. The politics is the way that people of power seek to convince you that their self-interest is your own. Governments understand self-interest. That is why governments are very good at designing programs which give things to people. Originally, governments had very limited functions. Their purpose was simply to preserve and to protect. Then someone added, provide. When governments began to be the people's provider, as well as the people's protector, governments started creating society rather than preserving.
But aren't governments simply doing what the people want? Don't governments merely provide the mechanisms through which the people provide for themselves on a societal scale? For instance, in America, we place a very high value on the dignity of human life, individual freedom, the importance of opportunity, the sanctity of children. So we've made laws and asked government to create programs to provide income for the elderly so they can retain their dignity past their earning years, to ensure equal employment and housing opportunities for all people, even those who are different from us or whose lifestyle we don't agree with, to guarantee through child labor laws that a nation's children don't become a nation's slaves and that no family with children goes without the basics of a life with dignity, food, clothing, shelter.
Such laws reflect well upon your society. Yet in providing for people's needs, you must be careful not to rob them of their greatest dignity, the exercise of personal power, individual creativity, and the single-minded ingenuity which allows people to notice that they can provide for themselves. It is a delicate balance which must be struck. You people seem to know only how to go from one extreme to the other. Either you want government to do it all for the people, or you want to kill all government programs and erase all government laws tomorrow.
Yes, and the problem is that there are so many who can't provide for themselves in a society which gives the best life opportunities routinely to those holding the right credentials, or perhaps not holding the wrong ones, who can't provide for themselves in a nation where landlords won't rent to large families. Companies won't promote women. Justice is too often a product of status. Access to preventive health care is limited to those with sufficient income, and where many other discriminations and inequalities exist on a massive scale.
Governments then must replace the conscience of the people?
No. Governments are the people's conscience, outspoken. It is through governments that people seek hope and determine to correct the ills of society.
That is well said, yet I repeat, you must take care not to smother yourself in laws, trying to guarantee people a chance to breathe. You cannot legislate morality. You cannot mandate equality. What is needed is a shift of collective consciousness, not an enforcer of collective conscience. Behavior and all laws and all government programs must spring from beings, must be a true reflection of who you are.
The laws of our society do reflect who we are. They say to everyone, this is how it is here in America. This is who Americans are.
In the best of cases, perhaps. But more often than not, your laws are the announcements of what those in power think you should be, but are not.
The elitist few instruct the ignorant many through the law.
Precisely.
What's wrong with that? No, really. If there are a few of the brightest and best among us to look at the problems of society, of the world, and propose solutions, does that not serve the many?
It depends on the motives of those few and on their clarity. Generally, nothing serves the many more than letting them govern themselves.
Anarchy. It's never worked.
You cannot grow and become great when you are constantly being told what to do by government.
It could be that government, and by that I mean the law by which we've chosen to govern ourselves, is a reflection of society's greatness, or lack thereof, that great societies pass great laws.
And very few of them. For in great societies, Very few laws are necessary.
Still, truly lawless societies are primitive societies where might is right. Laws are man's attempt to level the playing field, to ensure that what is truly right will prevail, weakness or strength notwithstanding. Without codes of behavior upon which we mutually agree, how could we coexist?
I'm not suggesting a world with no codes of behavior, no agreements. I am suggesting that your agreements and codes be based on a higher understanding and a grander definition of self-interest. What most laws actually do say is what the most powerful among you have as their vested interest. Let's just look at one example.
All right.
Smoking.
Hmm.
Now, the law says you cannot grow and use a certain kind of plant, hemp, because, so government tells you, it is not good for you. Yet the same government says it is all right to grow and use another kind of plant, tobacco, not because it is good for you. Indeed, the government itself says it is bad, but presumably because you've always done so. The real reason that the first plant is outlawed and the second is not has nothing to do with health. It has to do with economics, and that is to say, power. Your laws, therefore, do not reflect what your society thinks of itself and wishes to be. Your laws reflect where the power is.
No fair. No fair. You picked a situation where the contradictions are apparent. Most situations are not like that.
On the contrary, most are.
Then what is the solution?
To have as few laws, which are really limits, as possible. The reason the first weed is outlawed is only ostensibly about health. The truth is, the first weed is no more addictive and no more health risk than cigarettes or alcohol, both of which are protected by the law. Why is it then not allowed? Because if it were grown, half the cotton growers, nylon and rayon manufacturers, and timber products people in the world would go out of business. Hemp happens to be one of the most useful, strongest, toughest, longest-lasting materials on your planet. You cannot produce a better fiber for clothes, a stronger substance for ropes, an easier-to-grow and harvest source for pulp. You cut down hundreds of thousands of trees per year to give yourself Sunday papers so that you can read about the decimation of the world's forests. Hemp could provide you with millions of Sunday papers without cutting down one tree. Indeed, it could substitute for so many resource materials at one-tenth the cost. And that is the catch. Somebody loses money if this miraculous plant, which also has extraordinary medicinal properties, incidentally, is allowed to be grown. And that is why marijuana is illegal in your country. It is the same reason you've taken so long to mass-produce electric cars, provide affordable, sensible health care, or use solar heat and solar power in every home. You've had the wherewithal and the technology to produce all of these things for years. Why, then, do you not have them? Look to see who would lose money if you did. There you will find your answer. This is the great society of which you are so proud. Your great society has to be dragged, kicking and screaming, to consider the common good. Whenever a common good or collective good is mentioned, everyone yells communism. In your society, if providing for the good of the many does not produce a huge profit for someone, the good of the many is more often than not ignored. This is true not only in your country, but also around the world. The basic question facing humankind, therefore, is, can self-interest ever be replaced by the best interests, the common interest of humankind? If so, how? In the United States, you have tried to provide for the common interest, the best interest, through laws. You failed miserably. Your nation is the richest, most powerful on the earth, and it has one of the highest infant mortality rates. Why? Because poor people cannot afford quality prenatal and postnatal care, and your society is profit-driven. I cite this as just one example of your miserable failure. The fact that your babies are dying at a higher rate than most other industrialized nations in the world should bother you. It does not. That says volumes about where your priorities are as a society. Other countries provide for the sick and needy, the elderly and infirm. You provide for the rich and wealthy, the influential and the well-placed. 85% of retired Americans live in poverty. Many of these older Americans and most people on low income use the local hospital emergency room as their family doctor, seeking medical treatment under only the most dire of circumstances and receiving virtually no preventive health maintenance care at all. There's no profit, you see, in people who have little to spend. They've worn out their usefulness. And this is your great society.
Well, you make things sound pretty bad. Yet America has done more for the underprivileged and the unfortunate, both here and abroad, than any other nation on earth.
America has done much. That is observably true. Yet do you know that as a percentage of its gross national product, the United States provides proportionately less for foreign aid than many much smaller countries? The point is that before you allow yourself to become too self-congratulatory, perhaps you should look at the world around you. For if this is the best your world can do for the less fortunate, you all have much to learn. You live in a wasteful, decadent society. You've built into virtually everything you make what your engineers call planned obsolescence. Cars cost 3 times as much and last 1/3 as long. Clothes fall apart after the 10th wearing. You put chemicals in your food so they can stay on your shelf longer, even if it means your stay on the planet is shorter. You support, encourage, and enable sports teams to pay obscene salaries for ridiculous efforts while teachers, ministers, and researchers fighting to find a cure for the diseases which kill you go begging for money. You throw away more food each day in your nation's supermarkets, restaurants, and homes than it would take to feed half the world. Yet this is not an indictment, merely an observation. And not of the United States alone, for the attitudes that sicken the heart are epidemic around the world. The underprivileged everywhere must grovel and scrimp to merely stay alive, while the few in power protect and increase great hoards of cash, lie in sheets of silk, and each morning twist bathroom fixtures made of gold. And as emaciated children of ribs and skin die in the arms of weeping mothers, their country's leaders engage in political corruptions which keep donated foodstuffs from reaching the starving masses. No one seems to have the power to alter these conditions, yet the truth is, power is not the problem. No one seems to have the will. And thus it will always be, so long as no one sees another's plight as his own.
But why don't we? How can we see these atrocities daily and allow them to continue?
Because you don't care. It's a lack of caring. The entire planet faces a crisis of consciousness. You must decide whether you simply care for each other.
It seems such a pathetic question to have to ask. Why can't we love the members of our own family?
You do love the members of your own family. You simply have a very limited view of who your family members are. You don't consider yourself part of the human family. And so the problems of the human family are not your own.
How can the peoples of the earth change their worldview?
That depends on what you want to change it to.
Well, how can we eliminate more of the pain, more of the suffering?
By eliminating all separations between you. By constructing a new model of the world. By holding it within the framework of a new idea.
Which is?
Which is going to be a radical departure from the present worldview. Presently, you see the world, we're speaking geopolitically now, as a collection of nation-states, each sovereign, separate, and independent of each other. The internal problems of these independent nation-states are, by and large, not considered the problems of the group as a whole, unless and until they affect the group as a whole, or the most powerful members of that group. The group as a whole reacts to the conditions and problems of individual states based on the vested interests of the larger group. If no one in the larger group has anything to lose, conditions in an individual state could go to hell and no one would much care. Thousands can starve to death each year. Hundreds can die in civil war. Despots can pillage the countryside. Dictators and their armed thugs can rape, plunder, and murder. Regimes can strip the people of basic human rights, and the rest of you will do nothing. It is, you say, an internal problem. But when your interests are threatened there, when your investments, your security, your quality of life is on the line, you rally your nation and try to rally your world behind you and rush in where angels fear to tread. You then tell the big lie, claiming you are doing what you are doing for humanitarian reasons, to help the oppressed peoples of the world, when the truth is, you're simply protecting your own interests. The proof of this is where you do not have interests, you don't have concern.
Hey, the world's political machinery operates on self-interest. What else is new?
Something will have to be new if you wish your world to change. You must begin to see someone else's interests as your own. This will happen only when you reconstruct your global reality and govern yourselves accordingly.
Are you talking about a one-world government?
I am.
You know, you promised you'd get into larger geopolitical issues facing the planet, but I didn't think you would enter this debate.